Hi, my name is Stephanie Hinton, and you are listening to Passing Notes. For this episode of Passing Notes, I interviewed Claudia Swisher. Claudia is a 39-year teaching veteran, and now as a retired teacher, she spends her time advocating for public education. Claudia has taught students at every grade level and is a national board certified teacher. In this episode, Claudia and I talk about the current state of public education in Oklahoma and how teachers can engage in the political process.
So just introduce yourself.
Hey, my name's Claudia Swisher. I introduce myself in most situations as the resident loudmouth.
All right, so Miss Claudia Swisher.
Yes, ma'am.
Let's just talk about what is going on with the teacher walkout.
It's kind of been interesting. This is the first big movement that I've been on the outside watching. I'm a member of OREA, which is retired teachers, but I'm not a part of OEA in particular. But I've watched since 2008 when they started cutting education. And this was when oil was high. You know, the money was rolling in. And the ideologues in the legislature decided that they were going to do good old trickle-down economics and cut and cut and cut. Cut taxes, cut education. Since 2008, that is 10 years worth of kids going through school. My granddaughter is a sophomore in high school. She has never attended a fully resourced classroom.
Right.
Ever.
And I always tell people that was my first year of teaching was 2008. So my second graders that were my first class are now 12th graders.
Wow.
So they are, basically a generation that has missed quality education in our state.
They've missed the resources. One of the things that people like to say is, oh, well, you knew what you were getting into. And I was thinking about that on the way up here. They don't say that to doctors. They don't say that to lawyers. They don't say that to architects. They don't say, oh, well, the cost of living is so low here in Oklahoma. You can't afford to make this little pittance. They don't say that to any other professionals except the professionals they trust to educate their children.
Right.
And young people, young teachers now, I don't think are as patient as some of the folks in my generation and maybe a bit younger than me. We would take that low salary and go, oh, well, okay, I'll see if I can make this work. I tell people often, I taught for 40 years only because my husband was the breadwinner.
Yeah.
And I figured it out one time. And 1 month with my salary, I could have paid the mortgage and half the bills. The next month, I could have paid the mortgage and the other half of the bills. And I'm just certain that the electric company would have been happy with that. So I took from my family to be a teacher.
Sure.
I could have earned more someplace else. I chose not to. So we have all of these teachers who know what we're worth. We know what we do. We know how hard we've prepared ourselves. And we get told, oh, you knew you weren't going to get paid. What did you expect? You get 3 months off for the summer. There's the money, absolutely. There's the support, absolutely. And then there's that feeling of you work with kids, so you must not be worth as much as somebody who works with somebody else, you know, an older person. And maybe because I work with kids, I'm worth more. Maybe because I'm the ones with your children for hours a day, teaching them literature, teaching them how to get along. Perhaps I'm worth more than some of those other professionals. But I think young folks have just said, this is enough. I know the young man who started the Facebook page, which has just exploded. He's a second or a third year teacher. And as a male in the profession, he knows what he's worth, but he knows he's not getting it here. And young people shouldn't have to choose. I am a teacher to my core, but I can't support my family, so I'll have to go do something else. I had a principal one time who was doing an interview, and he asked me if I'd just kind of sit in and kind of pilot the questions with him. One of the questions was, if you couldn't be a teacher, what would you be? And the question utterly stumped me. And I finally said, well, I can't be anything but a teacher, but maybe I could go do something else, but I'd still be a teacher. We're losing those folks who are a teacher to their soul, and they can't feed their family without food stamps.
Right.
And no professional should have to make that choice. And I think there are just enough folks who are now saying, you've put us in an untenable situation, and we're saying enough. We marched in 1990. I have been to every one of the marches up at the Capitol, every one of the rallies at the Capitol. We've done them on spring break. We've done them, you know, on our own time.
Yeah.
And nothing changes.
Yeah.
Legislators too often say, oh, my sister's cousin's aunt was a teacher. My mom used to be. Every legislator has someone they say they value in education, but that doesn't translate into not only support for teachers and support personnel who are doing God's work, there's just no doubt about it, but per pupil funding.
Yeah.
If you value these children, put money in their education, and they don't. So I think it was just a kind of a perfect storm of watching for all these sessions, the first special session. They're called extraordinary sessions with an X. It's really funny. So we had an extraordinary session, and then we had an extraordinarily extraordinary session. In fact, that second extraordinary session is still going on, which is the only way they can maybe get a budget bill through quickly. Nothing happened. We heard all of this rhetoric, and we watched. Mm-hmm. And I understand the frustration. I don't like walking. I didn't want to strike in 1990, but there comes a time when that's the only professional choice you can make for your students and for the future of education in the state.
Sure.
Here we are.
Yeah, here we are. So in 1990, kind of talk to me about that. Do you see some of the same things going down that we saw in 1990, some of the same, I think that we have a lot of the same issues, which is very interesting to me, that we're just coming full circle back to having
full
the
circle.
Same issues that we had in 1990. But like you said, I think that is a lot of our teachers' concerns, is they're kind of afraid to walk out on their students. Like, that's so important to them. And
that's used.
That's used
against us.
But what I think is so interesting is that we are in a place where we are modeling right now for our students what civic action looks like. And so I've really encouraged the parents that I know, you know, go to the Capitol with your kids.
Oh, absolutely.
This is such a great learning opportunity for your children to know what this democracy in action looks like. So just...
You and I are sitting here on the day of the March for Our Lives.
Yes.
And I've been checking in and watching video. We may be behind our young people. They may be taking the lead. And, you know, these kids are saying our lives are important. And I really see my role to support them and say, yes, your life is important and your education, and we've got to get you ready. I teach a class at OSU with English language arts student interns. The year that they're doing their, or the semester they're doing their student teaching, they have class with me. And, you know, they're very concerned because what happens with my internship, because, you know, they have to have a certain number of weeks.
Yeah.
But there's also this feeling, this electric feeling of, I'm in the middle of history right now.
Absolutely.
And can I go up and can I watch? I think we're empowering our young folks to say, this isn't right, and we're going to do something about it. 1990 was different in that there was a bill, House Bill 1017. It was a lovely bipartisan piece of legislation. The Republican governor, Bellman, Bellman supported it. Democrats supported it, and it had just gotten lost in the shuffle. It had slowed down. Mm-hmm. And so we were going up to the Capitol to ask them to unstick it.
Yes.
And we marched the day, we didn't all go up all the time, but the day that Norman West Smith High went up, it was raining, it was nasty, it was cold. We marched around the Capitol, we went inside and did some advocacy work. That was the first time I'd ever talked to my legislator.
Wow, because you're a pro now.
Well, I certainly feel more comfortable doing it now, but you know, we all start someplace.
Yeah.
And we didn't know how to do it very well, but you know, we were passionate and we wanted these bills, this bill to pass. We wanted those reforms. And what I think is so interesting, those reforms, positive reforms for schools. We think now, you know, in this climate, reforms mean something awful, means somebody's doing something to us.
That's what we're used to, right?
Yeah. But, you know, this, you said the class size mandate was put in place for little ones and for high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mandate for high school was I wasn't supposed to have any more than 120 kids a day. My last couple of years of teaching, and granted it was an elective,
mm-hmm.
and I encouraged them to kind of load my classes because that would help the other English teachers, but I had 150 to 160 kids a day in a classroom that was supposed to be designed for 24. So we were jammed in, we had to hold our elbows in.
What were some of the other reforms that were a part of House Bill 1017?
Well,
I think a lot of teachers have kind of, because our younger generation of teachers were in school during 1990
yeah.
and may not remember what that brought, other than classroom size. Was
classroom size, and the other piece that I liked, because I really love learning as a teacher, there was a mandated amount of professional development every teacher had to do every year, but then within 3 years. So all of that point system, mm-hmm. that you've got to count your points, that all started with 1017. And at one point, the plan was, if you did above and beyond that, you were actually going to get a bit of a stipend in the summertime, you know, once it counted all the points.
Right.
And I'm thinking maybe I got one. So
one stipend.
Those, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the two that come to mind, the ones that really affected me every day in my classroom.
Mm-hmm.
I know there were others, and I'm just completely blank
yeah.
on those. But those two had daily ramifications in
right.
my classroom. And you know, we saw the stipend go,
mm-hmm.
but not the mandate.
Right.
Not the requirement, but any kind of reward mm-hmm. at the end for going above and beyond. That's gone. We saw the class sizes just
right.
be decimated.
Which a lot of people don't realize that still is a mandate.
Exactly.
1017 has not gone away.
Mm-hmm.
Our classroom sizes are mandated. There is no longer a penalty
That's
for
right.
not following the mandate, which is why our classroom
exactly.
classes have skyrocketed in the last 5 years.
And it used to be that there was a penalty. A district would have to pay something,
mm-hmm.
but it would be a nominal amount. There was a bill, and it died, thank you, Jesus. There was a bill that was going to fine school districts for going over those classroom mandates. And we talked before about let's not blame educators and teachers, let's look at who the perpetrators are. The reason class sizes are huge is because education is not funded.
Right.
It's not supported. So you're taking money away from us, and when we have to respond with maybe a four-day week or
right.
maybe overstuffing classes, you're going to fine us?
Right. Well, and I think we've kind of turned a blame, too, towards school districts. Well, if a school district has to go to a four-day week, then they're not using their money well.
That's right.
Or they're not being smart about using their money. When in reality, we have school districts that are operating on a very, very thin budget.
Yeah,
and I, one thing, because I work in curriculum, one thing I think about a lot is we haven't had a curriculum budget in at least 3 or 4 years, so it's hard for us to keep updated curriculum in classrooms when we don't have any money for curriculum.
And I've noticed it's been interesting to contact legislators through this. Excuse me, I started. Well, they know me. In fact, one person, when I met him, He looked at me and he looked at my name tag and he said, "You're one of those emailers, aren't you?" Yes, sir, I am. But I'm seeing a couple of scenarios coming out from legislators who are not as supportive as others. Mm-hmm. And one of those scenarios is, oh, it's all administrators' fault. You know, we give them money. We give them more money now than we did in 2008 without reminding us that there are 40,000 more kids now in our school districts. Yeah. We give them more money, so if you're not getting raises, it's their fault. I mean, I got a message from a legislator who said that. So, okay, so I know now how to arrange my information and my argument with you, because you've just used some half-truths, some untruths, and you've kind of mixed that in. One of the plans will, if everything works well and your fingers and toes are crossed, will get a teacher raise, but nothing for the classroom and nothing for support personnel. And someone said, well, but the state doesn't mandate support personnel salaries, and that's true.
True.
But their salaries come from the per pupil.
Right.
So when you cut per pupil,
right,
you are not giving the schools the resources they need in order to fully fund all of those support personnel. And, you know, administrative costs. Administrative costs are tiny. They're low, 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 mm-hmm. like almost 4% lower than they're
right.
required to be. And people don't know that includes office folks. That includes your cafeteria
right.
workers, that includes your custodians, that's the bus drivers. So you want to cut administrative costs,
right.
so you want to cut our bus drivers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, learning more just makes you angrier sometimes. It just
well, and education funding is so complex,
mm-hmm.
and I actually had to take a class in it,
wow.
and I didn't realize how complex it was until I took that class. And I work for a school district that is predominantly low-income, and
yep.
so we receive a lot of Title I federal funds,
funds.
But we can't just use that for
no.
anything, and we definitely can't use that for teachers.
No.
You know, paying teachers directly comes from the state.
Bond money is local money
mm-hmm.
that districts or communities choose to invest in the infrastructure of their schools.
Right.
And, you know, I hear people say, well, look at their football stadium. It's so amazing, so you can't tell me they don't have money to pay teachers. We don't have money to pay teachers because
right.
that must be used. In fact, there were a couple of people on the school board,
mm-hmm.
the Oklahoma school board, who were saying, well, just pay teachers bond money. You can't do it.
Yeah, that's not
and
sustainable
I only know, yeah,
on top of that.
I only know a tiny little bit. You know, I know there's this pot of money and this, and there's federal and there's state, but the Oklahoma Constitution was very, very clear about the fact that a free and appropriate public education was the right of every child in this state.
Yeah.
And they're not getting it.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
The teachers are doing everything they can. They are sacrificing. Administrators, I was raised by a principal. My daddy was my junior high principal. I want you to think about that. Your daddy is in school with you every day through 7th and 8th grade.
I bet you behaved yourself, though.
Oh, I was terrified. I was terrified. So I understand that situation and that, you know, that set of problems and difficulties. I have lots and lots of friends who are administrators. I walk with a woman who was a principal for years and years, and they are just as dedicated and just as sacrificing as any teacher
absolutely.
You're going to find. And they're trying to do the best for everybody in their community. They're trying to reflect who their community is. There's not an educator in this state who hasn't given everything he or she's got to give. And
I think we see that at every level in the school district, right? Because we've got principals who are doing everything they can to support
yeah.
their community. We've got school district leaders right now, especially. It's so interesting because this hasn't been a fight between a group of teachers and a school board. It's been everybody at every level in the school district turning to the state and saying, what now?
Yeah, and to watch the school boards meet,
absolutely.
I listened to some of the Norman mm-hmm. School board meeting, and the eloquence of our superintendent and those board members looking teachers in the eye and saying, we'll do whatever you need. We're in this together. And I'm hoping legislators see that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just teachers. It's not just the evil administration.
Yeah.
And as you said, if we can get kids and families involved. In fact, my daughter was in fifth grade. Now her oldest daughter is a senior in high school and will be voting in June. And she's got it marked with a great big red X.
Good girl.
And she said, can I come up with you?
Mm-hmm.
And the symbolism of my fighting that long for fairness in public education and leaving my daughter at home when she was in fifth grade to go do this, and now taking my granddaughter. It's time. It's past time.
So that kind of brings me to what's an important point that I wanted to talk to you about. You were there in 1990, mm-hmm. and now you're going to be there on April 2nd. A lot of what we accomplished in 1990 is gone, and now we're asking for the same things in 2018.
We are.
How do we prevent this cycle from happening again? You know, are there things that you've seen over the last 28 years that makes you think, well, maybe we should have done this differently, or maybe going forward we need to consider these things so we're not here in 15 years again.
Okay, I'm going to get on my soapbox here.
Go for it.
We've got to be engaged citizens and voters.
And we talked about that a little bit earlier, how it is difficult for educators to stay engaged when you work 40 plus hours a week. And you know, an English teacher, you're going home reading papers.
Every night.
I don't have a single friend who's an English teacher who doesn't spend hours grading.
Somebody put something on Facebook, bringing papers on a vacation. And I took the papers with me all the time. There are ways. You can get involved in some of the Facebook groups. You can, if your school district has a strong teachers organization, usually those leaders are really plugged in and engaged. You ask people. But I love my colleagues, but some of them are not registered to vote.
I
love my colleagues.
Yeah.
But some of them don't know who their state representative and their state senator are. One state senator keeps records, because, you know, all of that's public.
Mm-hmm.
And in his district, only 30% of teachers vote.
Yeah.
And when the dentist was in the State Department of Education, her statistics said 18% of us voted.
Wow.
So, yes, it's difficult to get engaged, but you find somebody who you trust who can help you sift through information. I kind of see that as my self-appointed goal and role right now is just, you know, go up to the Capitol, ask questions, look through the bills. In fact, just this morning, I looked through all of the education bills that were introduced in February. And how many of them are still alive? And it's way fewer than a fourth.
Oh, wow.
So we don't have a whole lot to watch now. But you find somebody you trust. And too often, teachers in Oklahoma don't vote for education.
And they don't even realize it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
they're listening to one person or another, and I'd love for them to broaden out the people to whom they listen, and find some time to ask some questions.
Sure.
Get in contact with somebody who knows more, and just say, "Can you help me? Can you help me look at a candidate website?" And look for the keywords, and look for the trigger words.
Well, and anymore now, I find that legislators, when they're running for office, they're pretty engaged on social media. And so that's how I've gotten to know some of them, is just sending them a message on Facebook or a tweet on Twitter and tagging them in it, asking them questions. And I've been really amazed at the, and some don't. I mean, my personal senator does not, he doesn't respond to my emails or my phone calls either, but my house representative does.
Good.
You know, and we have a very good relationship. Mm-hmm. I can shoot him an email and he'll email me back and let me know how he's voting on something or ask me questions or ask me what I think about it when it comes to education. And I think it's really important for educators to build those relationships with their House and Senate because then you become the person that they can go to. And I know my representative, he's got a group of teachers that he's like, how does this look in your classroom?
Oh, that's fantastic. When I first started, I would just shoot these emails out to people. And I did that, and someone from the Stillwater area, and I do not remember his name, called me. And he said, okay, let me give you some advice. And he said, you want to reach out to your legislators, introduce yourself, tell them your issues, what do you care about? Because he said, here's your goal. When your legislator votes on an issue that he knows you care about, it's your face he sees as he's voting. Mm-hmm. And that kind of made me go back into the classroom. What are teachers amazing at doing? Building relationships.
Yeah.
We build relationships with our students, with their parents, with our administrators, with the other people on our team. That's one of our strengths as a profession. So we use that. 2 years ago, I moved from one part of Norman to another part, and I had to say goodbye to my old state house rep and my senator, and I got new ones. So, you know, once most of the stuff was put in place in my house, I called them and I said, we need to meet. You have inherited a new constituent, and we need to know each other. And so we sat and we had coffee. And I said, I'm an education voter. But here's what education means to me. It means prenatal care. It means baby care. It means health care. It means health insurance. It means a living wage for mommy and daddy. And it means public libraries and preschool education. And you know, their eyes were getting bigger and bigger. I said, my definition of education is very, very broad.
Yeah.
And those are the issues I'll be watching, and those are the issues I care about. And one of them, I won't say which one, as we were ready to leave, said, well, you know, I just don't believe that schools should be feeding kids. And I mean, we were both standing up, ready to leave. I sat back down, and I said, and I had facts, and that's the other thing we need to do. I said, you do know that child poverty in our state is higher than the national average. Mm-hmm. And if we're not feeding children, they're not going to eat. Mm-hmm. Oh, but that should be a parent's job. Well, sir, if they're working three jobs. And so we have to be real clear about those issues we care about.
Right.
And so we can be the face that they see. And sometimes, you know, they're rolling their eyes going, oh, God, Swisher's going to be up here.
Thank you for listening to Passing Notes. The rest of my conversation with Claudia Swisher will be released Friday at 6 a.m. Graphic design for Passing Notes was done by Jordan Koff. You can find and view his work on Facebook or at www.jordankoff.com. Please share your thoughts, questions, and suggestions with me on the blog Passing Notes with Stephanie Hinton or on Twitter at @TheStephHinton.